Hello, everybody. We are glad you're with us today. Zarina is sitting in the Note School headquarters in Southlake, Texas.
That's right.
You're hanging out in the kitchen, aren't you, Zarina?
I am, and I got Mr. Mangan in here trying to get some cookies.
Well, I'm glad we're keeping it silent, keeping that private amongst you and I. So you guys say hi to the Titaniums that are here this week. Hey.
Hello.
We've had a fun time, and we are kind of on the backside of day two of our visit here, and I think it's really been good. We had a really great group, and several of our Note School staff is going to come participate in the Titaniums over the next few visits. And Zarina, that you are doing that this week, right? Just nod your head. All right, so we have a special guest today. We've got Chris Cobb and several of the management team with National Asset Advisors, and they are going to come start out the day with a presentation. So, Zarina, I'm going to click out, let them have full screen. Mr. Chris, welcome, sir.
Thanks, Eddie. Hi, everybody. Just to give you a quick introduction, the way the companies are organized, National Asset Mortgage is a servicer, and National Asset Advisors provides default services to National Asset Mortgage for various assets that are in default or delinquency. So we thought it'd be a good idea to on an NPL call to talk about non-performing loans and how we go about with process and procedure as it relates to those assets. So joining me is our in-house counsel and the department head of the Default Services Group, Cheryl Wine, and our paralegal, Meredith Peake. And they are primarily responsible for the recovery process when these assets are, when it's determined that these assets are going to be recovered. So we thought we'd take you through a quick little overview of that process, and then Cheryl has some case studies that she'll review with you briefly, just to give you an idea of the kinds of things that we encounter and sort of how it can move through the system, and also at the end of the day, what happens once these assets are recovered. As you know, National Asset Mortgage provides servicing, loan servicing. Works with borrowers and vendees, as they're called technically under an owner finance contract, an installment contract. They work with them daily. They do they have various levels of call lists that they work on a daily basis, depending on the delinquency status of the account that they're assigned to. Once an account gets beyond, at any time the servicing agent believes that there's an issue on the account and isn't sure that the property is actually occupied, they'll order an occupancy check. So they're performed at regular intervals to try to see if, what's going on at the property at the on-site itself. So, sorry about that. I think we typically see those coming in around day 60, and then we do them periodically after that to keep abreast of what might be going on at the property. At any time, if a vendor finds a property abandoned or vacant, they will lock and secure it at that point in time. And depending on the state, we may or may not have an asset that is considered recovered. So we'll get into that a little later. For properties that are delinquent, our servicing group is also going through loss mitigation options that are available to the vendees. These are largely a statutory and federal requirement. They're pretty highly regulated these days with regard to whether or not you're giving borrowers under these contracts, every option to stay in the property. Once a property gets to 120 days, we have made the decision to send that property to legal. We've probably exhausted as much energy as we could to try to recover the property in a non-legal form, which would include repossession or surrender or just a simple mutual release, or in some cases a cash for keys contract that would provide the borrower or the vendee with some sort of stipend to deliver the property broom clean swept and uncluttered, as it were. With regard to loss mitigation, we look for reinstatement, repayment plans, contract modifications. Cash for keys is loss mitigation. Mutual release would be a loss mitigation process. In rare cases, a refinance through a third party, or just a simple payoff, which happens on occasion, actually more than you think, probably. Or we would generate a sale to a third party, which is largely driven by what the customers desire. You know, our client, the investor, property owner's desires are with regard to that. Once loss mitigation is exhausted, and we know we're going to have to go through some sort of legal process in order to recover the property, then we'll refer that to our legal department. At which point in time, Cheryl and her team will take over the property and sort of begin to work it through the system. So Cheryl, I'll let her explain sort of the types of things that they do in order to try to get the property into the system and get it recovered, get the notices done, and in many cases, Meredith is also working hard to try to collect payment and either get the property reinstated to a status that's below 60 days delinquent, or to actually get a payoff in house, which happened last week. Cheryl, why don't you take us through the process?
Okay. As Chris said, you know, the first step, some of the first steps that we perform when it comes into the legal area is repetitive action from that they've already experienced in the servicing side of the business. So we will review the contract, we review the payment history. And the first action we'll take is to call the customer and see if we can reach them and reach any type of resolution. And one reason we do that is because we know that there is a cost to any type of litigation and any kind of recovery effort. So we do our best to keep costs minimal if we can by resolving the problem up front. If we do not reach them and we can't reach a resolution, we take the first step of referring it to local counsel, who sends a notice of default or a termination of contract, depending on what is required by that particular state. A lot of times we get a response once that initial letter comes from the attorney's office. They get the letterhead, they see that an attorney's trying to contact them, and even though we've probably made numerous telephone calls, this is the first time they realize that we're serious. So a lot of times we'll get responses back that gives Meredith an opportunity to talk with the customer, look at the options available to see if they can reinstate, if they can pay off. When we talk about the third-party sale, sometimes they have a family member there who wants to stay on the property, so we'll sell the property to them if they qualify. So there's some options we can get to if they're interested. Now, if we don't get a response between 10 and 30 days, and again, that's based on state law requirements, They have to have notice for a given period. If we don't get a response, then a complaint is filed, and we try to serve the defendant, or if the attorneys that we've contracted with are trying to serve the parties with notice of the complaint. Once the complaint is filed, a hearing will be scheduled, the hearing's held, and then a decision is reached by the judge. Now, there is a redemption period in most states, and it will vary. And a redemption period means that the judge is going to give the vendee a period of time to pay what they owe before they take the house from them. And, you know, we live in a society where it's important to have a place to live, so the courts are very reluctant to move people out of their homes, and it creates a lot of safeguards that they've put in place to make sure that the occupant has plenty of opportunity to try to correct the situation. So that's where a lot of these rules have come into play over the years. So the judge will give them a period of time within which to pay off, or, you know, pay the amount past due so that they can keep the home. This period of time could be
anywhere from 10 days to 90 days.
To 90 days, yeah. And the 90 days, that's a tough one because it's a long period of time. And we have no control over that time period as a company. You just have to go with what the court decides. And then they'll be given a date to move out if they don't pay, and the courts can enforce it through eviction. Once they've been removed from the property, then the property's secured, and we can prepare it for sale to the next vendee. Okay, what we found is there are several different types of recovery actions. That we've got the non-legal recovery actions and the legal. The non-legal are our attempts to have the vendee release the property to us just by agreement. We generally don't go after deficiency judgments, which means we don't ask them to pay the full amount due. We just say, walk away, let it go. Of course, we want it clean when they leave. And just sign the mutual release. They sign a quitclaim deed, and we can remove them from the property. That's one of the least expensive ways. A cash for keys, we may pay. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to interject here. I want to make a distinction here, Cheryl, to make sure everybody understands that they're not illegal recovery actions. They're just not. They just don't require a court in order to execute.
Right. Exactly.
They're not illegal.
These are efforts that don't cost you attorney's fees. That's basically what it is. Our cash for keys program is when we offer the vendee money to move from the premises. And one of the reasons you do that is because the vendee may find it difficult to leave if they don't have another place to go. So what you do is you encourage them by giving them, usually it's enough money to get them out the door into another lease. Maybe they need $500 for a down payment. Maybe they need $500 down payment and $500 for first month rent. And so giving them some amount of cash will help them make that transition. So that's the concept behind the Cash for Keys program. The amount may vary depending on the state, the location, and what we do is ask them to have the property clean and ready to be turned in. The advantage for the investor for this type of program is, one, you can encourage them to leave before you spend legal fees. Two, you can get the property cleaned without having to send in a third-party vendor to clean the property and get it ready for sale. And that can save you anywhere between $500 to $3,000, depending on whether you have somebody who has a lot of personal goods or not. So the Cash for Keys program, even though you're handing out some cash there, you're saving by not having to spend legal fees. You've got repossession and surrender, which is part of the mutual release program, really. They may just surrender the property to you and say, I can't handle it. And they would contact us for that. Now, as far as legal actions go, let's say none of those work, and we're going to have to put a little bit more money in. Our notice of termination, of course, starts the process for legal action. But then several states, we've got forfeiture actions, foreclosure actions, and dispossessory. Dispossessory is specific to Georgia, but each state will handle it a little differently. Their time frames will vary. If we have title issues, there's not clear title, meaning that it hasn't passed from one person to the next and had all the liens paid and that type of thing, we may have to seek a quiet title action, but that's going to be the exception. Go to the next screen. We have found that the timeline to recover varies by state. Part of it is because some states will require that you give a termination notice of 10 days. Some may require 30 days. Some courts may be very busy, so they may not be able to schedule a hearing quickly. Some courts, they all have different redemption periods, the amount of time they're going to give the vendee to recover or to pay off the property. So it could be 10 days to 90 days. So all of that plays into how long the full recovery process takes, and we'll look at some specifics in a minute. But the majority of states, it's going to take you, I would say, 4 to 7 months, really. So you've got our 3 to 6 months, which is going to be more typical, 7 to 12 months. Certain states, it's going to take a little longer. Then you have states where either the courts are really backed up or their laws are very stringent, and those will take 12 months or more to complete the recovery process. Now, we're going to go into some examples. I've asked Meredith to review some of these with you. She does these on a daily basis, so she could probably give you more than the three we've got listed, but we'll start with these.
The first one in Michigan, the contract was executed in April of 2012. First payment was due in May of 2012. The last payment that we received on that account was March of 2014. We referred this account to our local council in Michigan in September of 2014. The initial demand letter would have went out. The complaint was filed in December. Hearing was scheduled in January with the 90-day redemption period in Michigan. The court eviction wasn't completed until June of 15. So that one took approximately 9 months to finish. The next two in Ohio, the one in Dayton was actually referred to legal counsel, in October of 15. The vendee, our customer, signed a mutual release in December, but her mother and brother were actually residing in the property. She lived in a completely different state, didn't realize they weren't paying. I spoke with the brother, and they wanted to purchase, so we had our sales department send out the initial request for information that we would send out to any new customer interested in purchasing a property, and the mother and brother went MIA. So we proceeded with the hearing on January 8th of 16, and then that court eviction was completed on January 22nd. So that one took 3 months. There's another example there in Ohio that took 2.5 months. But I did look up a couple more. One was in Georgia where we do a dispossessory because that time frame seems to be a little shorter. This one was actually in Macon, Georgia, in Bibb County. We referred this case to our local council there on April 6th of this year. The demand letter was sent out on April 7th. It's a 10-day demand letter. On the 18th, we filed the dispossessory with the court. The customer had a deadline to answer by the 29th of April. The dispossessory was actually served by being posted at the property on the 22nd. The customer filed an answer on the 25th of April, so we had a hearing date of May 16th. The customer, even though she answered the complaint, never showed up for court. So the judge, instead of granting a 10-day redemption period, which is standard in Georgia, granted us an immediate writ of possession because she was a no-show. And then our court eviction set out was completed in June, on June 3rd. Dispossessories in Georgia take about 45 to 60 days and normally have that 10-day redemption period, but because this customer filed an answer but then didn't show up in court, we were able to get the immediate writ. Okay. Then we
so
have
one thing I just was going to point out. Oh, go ahead. Sorry, Meredith.
I'm sorry. I was just going to, we had an example in Jefferson County, Alabama. And the only reason I bring up Jefferson County, Alabama is because the once we get our judgment, which takes approximately 3 months in Alabama from the initial demand letter to the actual court date with judgment, Jefferson County does their own set out. We're not able to send a vendee or a vendor to the property to meet the sheriff to do the set out. Jefferson County does their own, and they currently run 45 to 60 days out on getting those done, sometimes longer depending on the area and how backed up Jefferson County is. So Jefferson County, even though you get your judgment in approximately 3 months, waiting on that set out takes a good bit of time in Jefferson County.
So I was just going to point out that the property in Ohio, the Kensington property, that was actually a little bit of a hybrid. Because the mutual release was signed, there wasn't any reason that once that was recorded, there was no question about the title and who actually possessed the property, but we had to do an eviction. So that was really a straight eviction of what essentially was a squatter.
Correct.
And you can see that took roughly 2 weeks. That happens. I think that the thing that is goes through all of these is how different they all are. I'll tell you, the Michigan property, it took 9 months to get that property back, but once we got it back and clear title, we were able to sell that property all cash for just under $30,000. And the two Ohio properties, one was resold and the note was sold. And the other one, the property owner did an all-cash sale on it. So there's good reason to go through the process, even though sometimes it seems like it takes a long time or it's frustrating. But once you can clear title legally, you have a lot more options. And it's the properties are generally, they're certainly more valuable if they're physically maintained.
Yeah. So in all these scenarios too, I just wanted to point this out. You guys are you're talking about specifically a land contracts. Not that you don't do foreclosure actions on regular mortgages, but I think the thing that's important is when we buy land contracts because we found a value buy that we don't have to go compete with all the money in the market. A lot of typical non-performing note investors don't really understand land contracts, and they certainly don't have vendors that understand land contracts. And Chris, we were on a call with you earlier today, and we talked about that a lot, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about that. I mean, you show up at the court, and your attorney, who is a specialist attorney in land contracts, has to go play school teacher, right?
That's typically the case. The courts are more oriented to a mortgage document that's much more uniform, typically. And we've Cheryl has taken a lot of time and effort, and we've used a lot of resources to review all of our contracts state by state by state to be sure that they're easily understood and that they are in concert with whatever individual statutes may exist that govern this. You don't have to foreclose in every state. In fact, correct me if I'm wrong, Cheryl, but I think in most states with a land contract, you really aren't foreclosing unless it's determined by a judge or a court or a magistrate that there's an equitable, you know, there's a real equitable interest in the property that needs to be foreclosed. And that's really the test on this. And it's a judgment call, but the time involved to get them back can vary, but a lot of it has to do with the type of instrument that they're just not used to seeing, because this business wasn't as regulated, you know, even 5 years ago as it is today. And, you know, the counties weren't as likely to reject your request to turn water on for a new client because they could see that there was a land contract recorded in the record or that they had a land contract on record that they had water turned on for previously. And so they want to see the mutual release. They want to see that it's been released so that they don't have to deal with, you know, they don't have two claims. So it's just a little more regulated, much more like a mortgage. So we've spent a lot of time trying to streamline our process so that it looks like what they're used to seeing, or so that we're, you know, working with council, local council that knows the document, knows how to present it, and knows how to go into court and you know, make the case that we need them to make in order to speed the process up. And Cheryl may have something to add to that.
Right. The land contract itself has been around probably a lot longer than the mortgage instrument. It's just that it's typically used on a smaller scale between individuals who want to sell their properties. So it doesn't hit the courts that often. They're not that familiar with it. Some states are moving away from it a little bit. So they've, like Michigan, has decided that it's more like a mortgage. West Virginia is probably the same way. They've decided that a land contract should be treated more like a mortgage. Whereas when you get into Mississippi, they see it more as a lease situation, and so you generally get out of the contract a lot faster, and that's what makes the recovery process faster. It's a landscape that's constantly changing, but like we were discussing earlier, it is something that we are, in a sense, teaching the judges about when our attorneys go into court. To recover their properties. So we have encountered this next screen. We have encountered some variables that do, from time to time, change the timeline that it takes to recover the property. And some of these include how long it takes to serve the vendee. So when we file a complaint, they have to inform the vendee that they've been served. So they will send a copy of the complaint or deliver it to the vendee. If we can't find them, if they're out of the country, sometimes they're in jail, you may have to do service by publication, which is a 3-week minimum, and there's some additional costs there. So sometimes we can experience delays for just different reasons. It could be that the courts are backed up. If the vendee counterclaims, and it doesn't have to be a reasonable claim or even a good claim, it just has to be that they respond, that may slow things down a bit. But we keep our eyes open to determine when the property is vacated. In some states, you can move more quickly if they've already left. So we take advantage of that when we can. So I think the challenge in the recovery process is that it's just the amount of time it takes, compared to, I guess, our current society where we like things to be done more quickly. And our updates tend to be 30 days apart at a minimum because we are waiting for the court to tell us what happened. So we're either waiting for a court date, we're waiting for a judgment, we're waiting for a redemption period to expire or a notice period to expire. So a lot of times I think we frustrate some of our customers because they want something to happen every other day. And unfortunately, in the legal system, it's about a 30-day process before anything happens. So we try to touch all of these accounts a minimum of one time a month. We're fortunate in the counsel that we have are very good at keeping us informed. So as soon as they know something, they tell us, and then we can share that information. So it's an interesting field that both Meredith and I enjoy, but it's I know it can be frustrating sometimes for the customers.
So, Cheryl, I was going to ask you a couple of questions. We've got a question that came up here on the board, and I'm going to sort of set a premise here that, you know, not a lot of buyers of defaulted loans buy land contracts. I mean, I would say the note school audience is very unique in the market for that, and once again, the advantage there is that we buy assets that, you know, aren't as pricey as some of the other assets that are out there. It does take, clearly it takes a specialized knowledge to be able to do it. One of the things that we are frequently asked, and as people are been longer in the note school, they kind of understand the title issue. But Gloria had a question here about judgments that could come up or any kind of liens that could come up against a borrower. Cheryl, and just talk to us a little bit about that, in that if what happens if a guy's got all kind of junk against him, how does that get my property title?
Okay, what's the situation?
Eddie, I apologize. You kind of broke up there at the end, so I didn't hear your question.
Okay, that's okay. So what we're really asking is let's say that our borrower, John Doe, has judgments against him or anything that would normally attach to real estate, and you got a senior lien and then that becomes a junior lien, but that's a different
if it's an estate that we have to foreclose on, those are named in the foreclosure,
but technically they have title to the property, correct?
I'm sorry, it's in a foreclosure state, it would tie to the property, but like I said, we name it in the foreclosure suit. In a forfeiture, it normally does not attach to the property. It just attaches to the person.
Because, once again, you've never given them title to the property yet.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. Title passes at the end with the land contract. So they have to pay it off and then title transfers.
So one of the advantages in a land contract is that the odds of doing a deed in lieu or cash for keys are better because you don't have that junior lien that kind of messes up the chances the buyer walking away. Is that
correct?
A fair statement?
Right. Yeah, that's fair.
So we always try to kind of talk about the pros and the cons of land contracts, and I wanted to kind of verify two things and see if you guys agree with this. First of all, generally speaking, it's easier to get repossession with a land contract than it is a note in a mortgage. True statement?
In the majority of states, yes.
Okay. And then secondly, the chances of doing a borrower workout where they're going to deed the property and walk away are better because there's no chance of having a junior lien against it. Well, I don't say no chance, but it's a lot less chances of having a junior lien attached that means you got to go foreclose and wipe it out.
Right. We don't encounter that situation as much. And you're also talking about financing that's in lower amounts. So we're dealing with amounts that when we deal with the customer as early as we do in the process, they're able to recover much better. You know, the NAMS servicing does an excellent job of staying in touch with the customer from the first day of the account being late forward. And as long as you don't have a great deal of debt adding up month by month, it's easier to work with the customer and find a solution so that they can stay on the property.
Correct. Okay, so Andy asked a great question, and I just want y'all to know that this whole thing of you're following the law really does kind of crimp your style of kind of getting repossession as quick as you want, right?
it does hinder our progress. So, you can no longer just take the front door off of a property in order to get somebody out. Yeah, that's right.
I was trying to make sure I was.
Hey, you're not allowed to do that anymore. They frown upon that.
Yeah. So Andy asked a question. He says, why do they wait 120 days before they send the attorney from the letter? Wouldn't it be better to send the attorney letter right after they are delinquent and try to get their attention sooner?
It absolutely would be better. We do send letters. We do send notices of delinquency every 30 days, sometimes every 15 days. I'll let Cheryl speak to the law, which is the reason 120 days is used.
Right. The CFPB has regulations that says you cannot begin the foreclosure process until 120 days has elapsed. And that's where that time period has come in. Like Chris said, statements are sent out on a monthly basis. So as soon as a customer is delinquent, a notice appears on their statement of, you know, you're late. Call us if you need help. You need to pay this amount. So in a sense, they're getting notified. The 120-day mark helps us meet the CFPB guidelines. Now, it's debatable as to whether we would be held to that standard in every single state. But the problem is it's such a gray area, and you can encounter so many issues that you're in a better position if you wait the 120 days. And then send the notice from counsel. Now, it could be that, you know, you can send the letter yourself basically after 120 days, but the risk is probably not worth it to do it earlier.
You
don't want the CFPB to do an investigation or to look behind what's going on. You want to keep them off your back.
Right. So for all of our Note School audience out there, the safest strategy is to wait the CFPB normally prescribed. You have to wait 120 days after they're delinquent to send legal notice of demand. Is that a correct way of saying it?
That's a fair statement.
Send them letters. You can tell them you're delinquent. You're going to tell them that they need to resolve it. You just can't say you are in default and we are demanding payment until that 120th day.
Taking legal action, right? Because we're beginning the foreclosure process when we send the notice of demand from counsel.
Okay, cool. All right. So if you guys have a couple of minutes. I know that we have, Sarah, don't we have a case from Kevin Moan that kind of relates to this?
Yes, we do. Let me just scroll down to that.
And we're asked on a regular basis by Note School folks, you know, hey, I want to do this or whatever, and this is a great topic, excellent topic for the webinars on a regular basis. I knew we happened to have the National Asset Advisors and their sister companies on the call today, so I thought it would be good to kind of dovetail this in. So, Mr. Cobb, you know Kevin Moan?
I do. Absolutely.
All right, so he's got an asset. I don't know if you can see the screen, but he's got an asset that is now 100 days delinquent.
For some reason, I'm not seeing the screen. I'm not sure why. Oh, I got it. Okay.
So he modified
a mod.
He did a mod. That it's a redefault situation. And what? Remind me, Sarah, what he called this letter? He had
an option letter, I believe.
Is that some kind of a term that I just haven't heard, Chris?
It might be referring to like a loss mitigation option.
I know
could
this.
I'm not familiar with it.
Service by FCI, and I know all different servicers have different terms, and so, you know, I can't really say. Maybe that's just that's sort of an in-house term they use. I knew it wasn't something I'd heard. But you guys have saying it's not an industry standard communication.
This is a letter that is, it looks like it's a loss mitigation notice. You have several options to correct your delinquency because you can either make a lump sum payment, you can do a cash for keys, you can do a foreclosure. That's what we consider a loss mitigation, and it occurs between 90 and 120 days.
And Kevin is on here, but he has himself muted. So, Kevin, if you can unmute yourself.
All right, great. I'm here.
Cool. Kevin?
Yeah, Eddie, I just made that term up. I just
We had our mortgage dictionary out, man.
Yeah, I'm rewriting the book. No, I heard someone say it, and it stuck in my head, but it's not the proper term. But just like they're saying, I was kind of thinking of it before, a demand letter where it's like, look, and also just to clarify, I haven't done a modification. We just had like a verbal agreement that they were going to get caught up when they got their tax return. And that happened. They actually did it. They got all caught up back in February or whatever it was. And then they just stopped paying again. And I reached out to them.
Yeah, well, they do that. They spend all their money and then they're stuck.
Yeah, well, I was hoping they'd have the monthly cash flow to cover their payment because it's relatively low, but that's not been the case, and I just told them a while back that if you guys go more than 3 months delinquent, I'm going to pursue other actions, so I just want to send this letter out to them and see what they want to do because they've obviously expressed an interest in staying in the past.
Right.
And I guess my best – I've been on for most of the call.
Let me set this up a little bit, Kevin.
Yeah.
When you guys buy an asset from us, or you buy an asset from somebody else, okay, the Note School stance is we want you to board it with the servicer, and we want the servicer to do all the communication with the borrower, okay? That's our official stance, okay? Now, I'm not crazy, and I know some of you guys do different things, like board it with the servicer, but you do some of the servicing yourself. Okay, that is not our prescribed formula, okay? But I wanted to, in all fairness, I think that's what you're doing here, right, Kevin? You've got it boarded, and so
It's boarded with the servicer who's doing all the servicing and sending the notices, but at some point I got in touch with these borrowers, and they've had my cell phone number ever since, and I've just talked with them on occasion when they needed help. They'd reach out to me.
Okay, so let me ask you a question. Are you going to send out this letter or the servicer going to send out this letter?
I was just going to ask if I should have National Asset Advisors step in at this point or if they'd recommend the servicer to send it or what. I reached out to an attorney to see what they would say, and I was just going to go that route and start foreclosure. But I guess I would take National Asset Advisors' suggestions on how to best go about that.
All right. Well, Chris, I'm going to let you guys run with it a second.
Well, I think Cheryl can provide some specifics on this, but my view is that this is a demand letter, and it needs to probably be sent by local counsel and be followed up with a court filing.
And we need to wait, right?
Do you have a servicer?
Maybe.
Or are you servicing it yourself?
No, I have a servicer that's doing the servicing.
Okay. You're most likely, Kevin, the servicer has this letter as part of their process already.
Right, okay.
I would think that they do. This communication relates to loss mitigation. And there are rules pertaining to loss mitigation, how it's supposed to work. There's a lot of deadlines, time frames, all this other stuff that the servicer has to track just per federal guidelines. So most likely, they've already got this in play. So your question to your servicer is just to say, have you tried any loss mitigation efforts, and have they been successful? And let them tell you what they've done so far. Because there, if you look, you know, number one, you're talking about a lump payment. That's just a payoff. I mean, are they going to either reinstatement is when you pay anything that's past due. So you can say, dear customer, are you going to reinstate your account and put you back where you should be? You know, you pay everything past due and start paying current. And a servicer is always going to ask that question, because that's the goal, to get them reinstated. They may, the next one they mention is Cash for Keys, which we talked about. And Cash for Keys is the program where we give them a little bit of money so they go ahead and move out and we can recover the property. And the third, of course, they've listed foreclosure, which in a land contract may or may not be the right terminology depending on which state you're in. But all of these actions are handled by your servicer. So if you do it along with them, you're sort of doubling efforts, but you don't have, you're probably not tracking the deadlines the way they are.
Right. And I'm pretty sure they haven't sent any of these letters out just because they CC me on, or they send me an email usually when they send them out, but I think I need to make a call to them today to get on the same page and see if they have a template that they'll send out like that one.
Yeah, so, or, you know, you should hopefully find servicers, and this is for everybody, that will do the work without you having to manage them, because this should be part of their process.
Okay.
So, Kevin, I used an analogy the other day, and that is boarding a loan with a servicer and not defining what you – they have to follow the law, right? But boarding a loan with a servicer and not defining – what you want to be done within the law is like going to a barber and not telling them how you want your hair cut. Just tell them to use their own creative juices. You might walk out of there with a little lopsided looking deal. And I trust me, I've just been to Seattle and I've seen a couple of those. So this is a good example. Obviously they have to follow the law, but You need to be in a situation. I think Chris is right. My just looking at it ahead of time, it looked a lot like a demand letter to me. And so, once again, you know, I'm not sure where you got that letter. Is that your letter or is that their letter?
I just drafted that and I sent it to an attorney, but I'm realizing this attorney is probably not experienced enough in land contracts and all that, so that's why I wanted to throw it to you guys and see what you had to say. But it sounds to me like I really need to call the servicer as the next step.
So just to tell you what we do a little bit, Kevin, with a situation like this, because it's a little different than what a servicer will do, although they may have a default services group or they may have a third-party vendor that provides default services work like we do to NAM. But NAM will send us the file, and Cheryl's group will start the legal action. And they'll send a demand letter out, and it's just purely a demand letter. And then we get that response from the borrower, and we're doing loss mitigation immediately with them. Under the guise of, hey, this has now been sent by a local attorney. We're moving forward with this process, but you have a window in which you can either make a lump sum to come current or pay it in full, refinance it, pay in full, or do a cash for key or do a mutual release. And that's part of what Meredith and Kirk do on a daily basis with accounts that have been sent to legal and have had that official demand letter delivered.
And you want to be careful just because you're not allowed to threaten legal action and then not take it. You've got to follow through. So that's the trick. And sometimes the way, you know, if you're drafting your own stuff, that's why attorneys step in, it's because you may have written it in a way that you think is appropriate, but we may know that the court is going to view it differently, just from case law or experience that we've gained through the process. So you want to be real careful of that because they just don't like threatening legal action without it being true.
Okay.
You need a good servicer is what you need, Kevin.
Yeah.
Any other questions? I actually did have a question. When you have a borrower who never lets it go to the 120 days, but is consistently like 60 to 90 days late, how do you handle that?
Good question. So typically, if you accept payment, then the time period can start over. So you have to make a decision beforehand whether you're going to accept payment or not. Because of the typical profile of the borrower that we deal with in the low value space for the most part, our job is to collect. Our job is to generate cash flow. So we're looking to do that. So if we can, our general rule of thumb is if we can to get the vendee to pay enough to reduce them to a sub 60-day delinquency, then we can get them back into the collection mode, and we can try to do a payment plan and try to work with them and try to keep them paying. And we do have accounts that will be rolling 60s. They'll make a payment every month, but they're still 60 days late. And for an investor that has a smaller number of assets, they typically want the cash flow. A large investor like a fund may be more interested in having current accounts as opposed to having paying accounts. I mean, I know it sounds counterintuitive, but that can happen. Because they may be compensated based on the currency of the portfolio as a portfolio manager, not on the cash flow they're generating. So, they may not want us to collect unless we're taking them current. So it's just different depending on the portfolio outlook. But as a rule, for someone that is trading in these contracts and doing it to generate maximum cash flow, they want us to collect. So that's what we do, and that's what we've always done. So, at the end of the day, it falls back on what do you really want? Do you want to have somebody paying every month or every 45 days and being behind all the time but still paying? Mm-hmm. Or do you want a current account that's paying every 30 days? And that's certainly the desire, but that's not always the reality in some of these properties, simply because of the nature of the instrument, the nature of the property and the neighborhood it's in and the type of borrower that we're dealing with who is really not able to buy a home and get a mortgage like you or I. So I mean I think it's sort of incumbent on the investor to have a plan about what they want to do, because we can certainly refuse payments. We can certainly take it into foreclosure.
There's two strategies. Okay, so Chris's firm services some loans for my mother-in-law. Okay. Mm-hmm. They're owned in her long-term retirement account. Right. If one of these customers gets delinquent and they can only make part of a payment, but we think they can get straightened out and pay again, mm-hmm. we'd probably rather see them pay $200 a month versus the $350 the contract called for, because we don't want to get them out of the habit of paying. Right.
Right.
If our capital fund buys that same asset, it might change the tradability of that loan from performing to sub-performing. Okay, so a part of it is Chris alluded to. It's kind of like where what your long term strategy is, and kind of how all that works as to what might be acceptable to you. Now, once again, the idea and the reason I'm going down this road is this is where you work with a servicer and say, here's what I'm trying to accomplish, and their job is to tell you what the law is, and then they try to execute the management plan depending on the law. Chris, questions before we let you guys go. One of them is, does this only pertain to land contracts? So what we've been discussing so far about default and and the borrower, you know, management, is that, does that relate to any type of defaulted loan?
Yeah, you're talking about the time periods and the demand letter and the, you know, how you go about the legal process. It does.
Yeah, the legal process is largely the same. Your contract is going to, you know, outline the terms of how it's to be terminated and what's going to happen in the event of default. But basically, it's the same. It may be shorter or longer for a mortgage or a different type of financial instrument to recover it, depending on the state you're in and what their rules are.
Secondly, what if the borrower include their late fee?
What does the borrower do?
The question is, what if the borrower does not include their late fee, but they're still a rolling 60?
Well, we typically, I mean, a lot of times we use the late fee to induce payment. But in our case, under our agreements, because of the fee structure, you know, late fees are at our discretion, and if we collect them, we keep them. So it's really something we use to try to generate payments.
Okay. All right. You guys are awesome.
Well, thanks, everybody. Thanks, Eddie. Thank you, Sarah, for
Thanks for being on.
If anybody has any questions after the fact, feel free to shoot them our way.
All right, perfect.
Oh, and by the way, Kevin, that property's in my hometown, so if you need anybody to I might know somebody that can go take the front door off if you need that.
apparently, we're having some sound issues because I'm certain I didn't hear you say what you said.
No, you didn't. I'm just kidding.
All right, guys. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right.
Thanks. All right. There are a couple other announcements. Let me just get there. One from Bob Repass about the September offering. Shared here. It is, we have a altered schedule because of Labor Day weekend. So the titanium offering will be on September 8th at approximately 1 o'clock. And then it'll be released to the remaining students on Tuesday, September 13th.
Okay.
And then we have the Note Expo event. Do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, so I want everybody to make sure it's on your calendar. We do have a couple of hundred mentor students that have already signed up for it, so we're certainly, a lot of you have already done it. But all the mentor students that have ever been to it in the past would tell you this is a you-can't-miss event. And so just make sure you put it on your calendars. We're going to have some deadline dates. So you guys need to, if you know you're coming, you need to go on and register because we're going to start closing down on your discounted registration and starting with the titanium visit on Wednesday night and a VIP reception and event, and then starting Thursday, and we'll have a long day Thursday. Registration is 8:30. We'll end up with the charity kind of banquet and auction that night, and it's very nice, and we provide dinner, and I guarantee you're going to like it. And that'll be in the evening. So Thursday will be a long day, and then Friday morning we start with Note Expo. So we'll have mostly staff on the appreciation event, and then we'll have industry speakers, other sellers of assets, other asset managers. We'll have a lot of variety. We had about 470 paid attendees last year, and we hope to grow from there this year. So this is the most significant Note event that the industry has, period. And so you're kind of at the core of it. So as a mentor student, you're going to want to make sure you're in the middle of that. So let's see. Yes, somebody asked about the time. Bob always speaks in central time. So when he says 1 o'clock, he means central time at 1 o'clock. So good question. Sarah, is that it?
That's all we have.
All right, so these guys here, let me show you this. These guys here, there's a few of them that have exited.
And they are fixing to go to a wine and cheese party.
Ooh.
And so here at the office. So Zarina's already in there. I don't know what's happened.
Too much for the wine, Eddie. Too much for the wine.
Did Megan sit there with you the whole time, Zarina?
No, no, I'm not even in there. I'm in the other office now.
Oh,
I've just been walking around.
Drink all the wine, and then she went to the other office.
All right. All right, well, it was fun having them here this week, and good session today, and we will see you, what do they say, tomorrow on the radio? Zarina, we're going to make an announcement pretty quick, aren't we?
Which one you want? Which one you want now?
You ain't ready for that yet, are you?
No, not yet.
All right.
Give me a week.
All right, we got some cool stuff coming up. We'll see you guys soon.
All right, thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.